case number 10-7007 et al. American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals et al. Appellants versus Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus et al. Mr. Phillips for the appellants, Mr. Simpson for appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Carter Phillips for the plaintiff appellants in this case. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The last time this case was before this Court, it sought out and followed what it described as the simplest path, which was to decide the issue on the narrowest basis available to it for reversing Judge Sullivan. I would urge the Court to follow the same course in this case at this time. However, I think the organizational standing argument is candidly the simpler basis on which to decide this case. And the Court, I don't think, needs to go much further than to review Judge Sullivan's single finding with respect, single conclusion of law with respect to resource allocation standing as it applies to API and compare it to this Court's statement in SPAN. In his conclusion, he says there was no, this is at 3317 of the Joint Appendix, there was no testimony that API would actually spend less resources on captive animal issues or even on elephants and circuses where FEI's practices declared to be a taking. And so he has imposed a very high burden on the plaintiff in this particular case, which is that they have to demonstrate not only that there has been an allocation of resources, but that they have to actually testify that those resources would not be expended for the same basic purpose of the organization in the event they were to prevail in this case. That is not what this Court held in SPAN. In SPAN, this Court said specifically at page 27 of 899 F. Second, Havens makes clear, however, that an organization establishes Article III injury if it alleges that purportedly illegal action increases the resources the group must devote to programs independent of its suit challenging the action. And in this case, Judge Sullivan specifically found the resources are in fact increased, have to be spent as a consequence of the defendant's actions in this particular case. And all that's required under Haven is that the plaintiff has to identify and counteract the illegal actions of the defendant. And the Court, in making that determination, has to assume, candidly, that there has been a violation of the statute under these particular circumstances. And all of the defendant's arguments, candidly, address the question on the assumption that there has not been a taking. Indeed, most of the statement of the case from the defendant is that there has been no taking, that what they do here is a perfectly permissible way to approach it. And of course, under those circumstances, no plaintiff would ever have standing because there's no violation, but that has it exactly wrong. What the Court needs to do is to assume standing. I'm sorry, Judge Tatel.
Well, go ahead and finish and then I'll ask
you. No, it's just that the Court has to assume standing.
Assume you're right. I mean, you are right. We have to assume that they're violating the statute and assume further that you're right about the district court's finding here. What's troubling me, I'll just lay it out on the table for you. What's troubling me is that the plaintiffs here still have to show that the defendant's actions caused the increased cost of their activities, right?
Right, absolutely.
Still have to prove causation, and we're beyond the motion to dismiss stage. So there has to be evidence on causation. And you say in your brief that the causation here is that the treatment of the elephants in the circuses, the use of bull hooks and chains, that conveys to the public, particularly to young people, right, that this treatment's okay, right?
Right, no question.
Yeah, and well, right, there's no question that that's in the brief, but the question is, where's the, I know you didn't try the case, but it's not in the affidavits that I could find, and I don't know that there's any evidence on that point. And don't we need that? Or I guess there's two questions. Question number one, am I asking for something that you think we don't need for you to prove standing?
Yeah, I think it's something.
Number two,
right, and then is there evidence to that effect?
Evidence,
yeah. Judge Tatel, I think the answer to your question is that is not something we need to prove under these particular circumstances. It seems to me it's a logical inference to draw from it. But the question, I think the only legal issue that the court has to decide is, you want me to go forward or?
No, you go ahead.
The only question is, is it a concrete and particularized injury in the sense that do we have to spend resources to identify and counteract or combat the illegality of the defendant's actions? And Judge Sullivan specifically finds, because these are not just monies that are spent in general in advocating on behalf of elephants.
I'm with you on the expenditure. I'm willing to assume that the affidavits are sufficient on that. I'm asking you the next standing question. And Lujan says that at this stage, at least at the post-summary judgment, and we're post-trial, that must set forth by affidavit or other evidence,
right,
specific facts to show causation.
Right.
I'm responding to your point. Well, it's just logical that the public treatment of the elephants will demonstrate to the public that this is a safe and humane treatment, which the plaintiff here has to counter with increased expenditures. So.
Right, but I think all that's required for a concrete and particularized showing is that it's not simply advocacy in the abstract, that it is in fact advocacy aimed directly at the wrongdoing of the specific defendant in this case.
That I'm asking about. I agree with you about that, but I'm asking you the proof question.
Right, but
what level of proof, and I'm really responding to your point, it's just logical. At this stage, the question then is, at this stage of the litigation, are we allowed to decide a standing question on the basis of, quote, it's logical to think that they would have, that the defendant's behavior caused the injury? That's the question I have.
Well, if the testimony of Ms. Peckhead, which is what it was, is that FEI's specific practices are what caused them to incur specific expenses. It's not mistreatment in general. It's FEI's specific mistreatment, both in terms of the conduct and in terms of their failure to provide critical information that they would have to through the permitting process otherwise. But those were two alternative arguments. But both of those are specific and particularized in their application to FEI. And that, I think, is precisely what the Supreme Court in Havens and what this court in Span requires of the plaintiff. And then, it seems to me, you can fairly infer the rest of what I argued and what's argued in the brief from the fact that we spend specifically to combat FEI's actions, and obviously if FEI stops doing what we believe is a violation of the statute, what the court has to assume is a violation of the statute, then obviously that will redress our particular problem.
Wouldn't every advocacy organization have exactly that same argument?
Right.
I mean, if you're an advocate because you oppose something that the defendant is doing, if the defendant stops doing it, you don't have to spend money opposing it anymore. So that would give standing to everybody who has a problem with anything.
Well, I do think it is a broad standing doctrine that I'm urging for the court, but it's not as broad as everybody has that right. Because Sierra Club says it's not enough simply that we would be offended by the idea of elephants being in a circus and advocating for that. That it seems to me that's not a resource allocation that is specific enough to this particular problem to justify standing under these circumstances. But if, in fact, we do, as API does, specifically allocate resources to identifying and combating this precise defendant's conduct, then it seems to me that that's a sufficiently concrete and particularized injury that is, in fact, redressable. The reason why this seems sweeping, I think, is largely because of the nature of the Endangered Species Act. Obviously, the endangered species cannot sue on their own behalf, so someone has to stand in their place. And Congress wrote what the Supreme Court recognized is an extraordinarily broad and very sweeping statute designed to deal precisely with this kind of a situation where you have the minimal showing for standing, which is injury, resource reallocation, and information deprivation.
It seems to me then you're defining actual injury as something that the plaintiff can always create. The defendant is doing X, I oppose X, I have spent money opposing X, therefore I have standing.
To be sure, there is something volitional in that, but this court in the Equal Rights Center recognized that the fact that these are volitional and voluntary payments and decisions made by the plaintiff that in terms of how they're going to allocate the resources is not the obstacle. This court carved out in that case a specific, I mean, it seems to me there are two limitations on the doctrine I've asked for. One is, obviously, it cannot be expenditures solely for preparation and actual litigation of the case. The court specifically held the contrary, and there's no doubt in this instance that API spent a lot of money prior to this litigation, not in anticipation of this litigation, and the district court didn't find to the contrary. And second, it is not sufficient that we simply have a strong preference for how animals ought to be treated. It's not, you know, that's exactly what the court said in Sierra Club is not adequate. What we have to do is, in fact, expend resources designed to halt a particular use.
Let me just pursue this, because as I understood it, you're not saying, you're agreeing that it isn't enough that you're seeking to halt the alleged mistreatment of the elephants.
Of all elephants.
Right? What you've spent the additional money on is to counter the public impression that the defendants are given by their treatment, correct?
Yes.
That's your argument. It's
right.
Like, it's just like Spann, right?
It is exactly like Spann.
If Spann was a motion to dismiss, now we're beyond it. And the question is, and I understood you were in your briefs, you were saying, look, this is pretty precise, and this is why you don't have to worry that we're creating standing for anybody. But you agree, don't you, that I'm understanding your case, your argument correctly, right? That critical to your argument about standing is not just that you're seeking to counter, to end the alleged mistreatment of elephants, but that the additional money is spent to counter the public impression given by the defendant's treatment of the elephants, right? That's your argument.
Well, I mean, to be sure, that is our argument.
Yeah.
I think, though, that you don't need to have specific testimony as to that. I think all you need to show is that it is the mistreatment.
Then I go back to Judge Brown's question. See, if we don't have evidence on that link, then basically any advocacy organization can claim it. Certainly at the motion to dismiss stage, that's enough. That's what Spann says. But we're beyond that now.
Right, but if you convert Spann, let's go back to the language of it, okay? Because what it says is, makes clear that an organization establishes Article III injury if it alleges. It seems to me that you could substitute for that if it proves that the illegal action increases the resources the group must devote to programs independent of its suit.
Where's that proof here? I'll ask one more time. The affidavit, you said, that's it.
That's the testimony of Ms. Paquette.
And it's her testimony that if they stop, we won't have to spend the money.
Correct. If they stop, we will. The bulk of the money won't be spent in that particular direction. And just say this one other point to make in regard to this, and that of course is the resource allocation specifically. Yeah. It doesn't go to the information deprivation argument. That's a separate argument, and it seems to me doesn't depend on that particular linkage at all. But I'll, unless there are questions, reserve my time. Yeah, good.
So in the opposing counsel's reply brief, they raised the issue of the Wynn case, the Supreme Court's recent decision regarding taxpayer standing under the Establishment Clause.
Right.
So how do you answer the argument? Assume there is a organization which has devoted its life and lots of money to trying to oppose legislation for tax credits going to parochial schools. And they lose. They're not litigating. They're only trying to prevent the legislature from doing what they regard as unconstitutional.
Right.
They lose. They try again, they lose, they ask for an amendment, they lose, and then they bring suit. And they say, look, if we win this suit, we will not have to continue to try to get the legislation changed. And this is the only thing we care about, and we're in Arizona or whatever state, I can't remember what state it was in. Do they have standing?
No, I don't think they have standing.
Right, so explain to me why it's different than this case.
Because what we are doing, I mean, it goes to Judge Tatel's point, I think, which is that this is not designed simply to get legislation, although that's part of the package, obviously. But what it's really designed to do is to rebut the clear inference that the public would draw from the very conduct that's ongoing, that this is a perfectly permissible way to behave.
Fair enough. So they say, Arizona passes this statute that certainly indicates to the public that it's okay to give tax credits for this purpose. We think it is not okay. We think it violates. The Supreme Court never has decided the underlying question. They're only deciding lack of standing. So our position is this gives the public the wrong view about what's constitutional under the Establishment Clause.
Right.
Is that the same as what you're saying?
I don't think so, because, again, all we're looking for is whether this is sufficiently concrete and particularized. And what you described...
Why isn't that? That's why
because that impresses me as simply a sort of a broad brush. We're seeking
broad advocacy. We don't want our state to give money for tuition credits. That's a very narrow thing, and we think that violates the Establishment Clause. That seems pretty narrow. I mean, less narrow than saying we don't want the circus to use.
We don't want this particular circus to be engaged in this particular kind. It seems to me that is the fundamental difference.
We don't want this particular state to provide it. They're not asking all states. They're asking their own state. Why is it?
Well, at some point, obviously, there's a line the court has to draw with respect to sort of what's permissible. And it seems to me the line is not at the stage where you're saying I don't think it's a public advocacy point. I think what the Supreme Court is trying to get at is that at some point everybody has the same basic claim, and saying that and limiting taxpayer standing and trying to limit the Article 3 in a particular way. I don't think that argument applies when you're talking about, first of all, a statute where Congress has conferred the broadest possible standing. So we're looking at what are the constitutional limitations, and at this point we're talking about a very particularized and concrete dispute between our organization, which spends money to identify and combat specific practices undertaken by the defendant, and if the court were to conclude that this is a take within the meaning of that statute, then we would not devote those particular resources. It seems to me that is a sufficiently particularized meaning within what this court said in SPAN, if you simply apply SPAN to the next level, which is to say it goes beyond, obviously, allegations. You have to prove it. It seems to me we proved it, and Judge Sullivan accepted our proof with respect to are those resources, in fact, being reallocated in a particular way. And the only inference is if they stop doing what they're doing, then we will stop having to spend those monies in that particular way.
Let me ask two more questions.
Of course.
On that issue, can you not read SPAN and the other, particularly the other housing discrimination cases, to say that they are not, those were organizations that were not in really, advocacy was part of what they're doing, but it wasn't the main thing that they were doing. The main thing they were doing was persuading people, helping people move into segregated neighborhoods, providing them with loans, providing them with counseling, et cetera. And that this was preventing, the illegal actions were preventing them from going about their other business. While your opposing counsel's argument is that the plaintiffs here don't have another business, their only business is to prevent, as you define it, is to prevent this tactic, this use of these two items.
Well, I mean, our business generally is to protect animals, not just elephants. So it's not. That's not our business. I mean, we are talking about a very specific and particularized, and I would argue, sufficiently concrete dispute between ourselves with respect to this to satisfy the minimal standards of Article 3.
And one last question: does the circus use the chains and the
bull hook
in front of the public?
On occasion, if need be. They try to conceal it as much as possible, but certainly in certain instances, yes, they have to. I mean, they as I say, they try to avoid it, and certainly in the CEC they do it, but if behind closed
doors.
The argument
is that we're trying to counter the suggestion that these things are okay.
Right.
But if these things are all actually done concealed, how does their using them give the public the notion that they're okay?
Well,
it actually sounds like it gives the opposite. We're hiding this.
Well, first of all, I don't think they do. In fact, I mean, hide it. I mean, they make an effort to, but there's no question that on occasion they do that. But I think the more fundamental point here is that the message that they are conveying is that the elephants are being treated in a very healthy and humane way, when in point of fact the animals are being treated, the elephants are being treated in a very unhealthy and very inhumane way. If you accept our theory of Section 9 and 10 of the Endangered Species Act.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
I'm May it please the court, John Simpson for Feld Entertainment. I'd just like to follow up, Judge Tatel, on what you mentioned with respect to affidavits, and that is, this is not based on affidavits. This case was tried in its entirety in a bench trial to the trial court, and it's the only case I'm aware of in my career in which the Article III issues of standing and the facts related thereto went to trial with the entire lawsuit. Both parties rested, both parties submitted this case to the court for decision. So this judge was in a particularly unique situation in that he had before him not only a full evidentiary record based on live testimony at trial with respect to the Article III issues, but also with respect to the merits itself.
So is it your theory that no advocacy organization, that is an organization whose entire function is public education and advocacy, as opposed to providing, you know, a specific service like counseling, is it your position that an organization like that can never have Haven standing?
I think in this situation that's true.
No. I'm not asking you in this situation.
I think in the situation of your question, I think that's true. I think unless the plaintiff organization can demonstrate that the defendant's conduct actually affects something they're doing, makes it harder to advocate.
That's my question. Right. It makes it harder to advocate.
Makes it.
Suppose they can actually show that. Suppose, for example, you've got an organization that's devoted to opposing nuclear power, right? And they're interested in they're opposing nuclear power plants, they're opposing nuclear weapons, everything, okay? And a power plant decides to build a new facility and to launch a $50 million public education program to convince the public that it's safe, right? And they sue and they say, look, we've had to reallocate all of our money to countering that public education program. Because, and not only that, we have a witness who says that as a result of the defendant's public education program, the latest poll shows that the public now, 75% of the public now thinks they're safe, whereas before the defendant's public education campaign, it was only 50%. So they've actually shown that the defendant has affected what the public thinks, make the public think that they're safer, and they're countering that with a much more expensive public education program. Now, would they have standing?
I don't think they would, and let me explain why.
Yeah, why?
Because that's nothing more than pure issue advocacy. You have a point of view about a specific social issue, and you spend your resources making that point of view known.
No, but if they're trying to counter a direct impact created by the defendant, why doesn't that fall directly under our case law?
Because your case law, for example,
Span says that you can engage in public education to counter the public impression given by the defendant's housing act.
Then I think that's the difference, is that's a case that's based on the dissemination of illegal information, i.e. the availability of housing. It's a Section 804D under the Fair Housing Act case, which prohibits...
For purposes of standing, that the plaintiffs are right that the defendant's treatment of elephants is, in fact, unlawful.
That's true. In the section of the statute that they've invoked, Section 9, says nothing about the dissemination of information about the elephants. And Ms. Paquette never testified. There's not one single word in her testimony that API spends a single nickel.
I understand that. That's why I was asking you a hypothetical.
But your hypothetical includes the concept of responding to what the nuclear industry is saying about the safety of its plants. There's no testimony in this case.
Yeah, that's why I called it a hypothetical.
That API, but there's no testimony.
It's not this case. That's why I called it a hypothetical.
Right, but there's no
testimony. My question, though, is hypothetically, I mean, I realize you say in this case there isn't a public education campaign and there's no evidence connecting their behavior to the public perception, but I'm trying to understand your basic position. Is it that even if there was such evidence, there would be no standing?
That's correct. I don't think that's any difference than Sierra Club, any difference in this court's decision in National Taxpayer Union, any difference than this court's decision in the Center for Law and Education. Because all three of those cases, except for Sierra Club, but the two lower court cases involved.
Span is wrong?
No, Span's correct, because in Span, the organization ministered to a constituency of people who were affected by the housing discrimination. And Span falls into the same fact pattern as Havens Realty and Fair Employment Council and Abigail Alliance in Action for Senior Alliance and the court's recent decision in Equal Rights Center, and that they had a program ongoing that was actively interfered with.
So many of the things in those cases could also be called public education, advocacy. I mean, it's a tough line to draw. I guess I'm trying to figure out why you would draw the line there. And again, it's just hypothetical. I don't see why you draw the line there, particularly since it's so difficult to draw. I mean, in Spain, many of their activities were very similar to what's going on here.
Except
at least what they claim they're trying to do.
Except in Spain, there was an active program of counseling and referral, right, that they allege was interfered with. And the plaintiff in this case never testified to any such interference with its advocacy. In fact, Feld Entertainment gives it something to advocate about. If anything, there's no injury, in fact, because Feld Entertainment continues to do what they oppose. And the more important point, not only is there no injury, in fact, but the specific remedy that she testified, or they ultimately sought from Judge Sullivan, which was very narrow from what they pleaded, which is, we want a declaratory judgment that use of the guide and use of tethers to present elephants in the circus is a take. There's no testimony whatsoever by Ms. Paquette that remedy would cause them to spend one nickel less on their circus campaign. So we think not only did they not prove it from an injury in fact standpoint, they didn't prove the redressability point. And at this point in the case, as Justice Scalia made clear in Lujan, the plaintiff has an obligation to prove all elements of standing with the same proof that you have to prove your main case. And they didn't do that. It's that simple. There are a lot of fine points here about organizational standing. We think these fair housing cases, every single one of them, is distinguishable on the ground that there was an organization that had an ongoing program of referral and counseling. They may have also had an educational aspect of that, but not one of those cases is based solely on the concept that spending money to advocate your position gives you injury, in fact, to sue whoever you're advocating against. Because if that were the case, all you'd have to do is spend 97 cents on a bumper sticker, put it on the back of your car, and you could sue whoever your bumper sticker opposes. That's essentially where this would lead. And we think that stretches Article 3 beyond its limits, beyond the limit that any court's ever accepted.
You want to say something about informational standing? What's your best argument about?
On informational injury, Your Honor, we don't think it even... The statute they've invoked imposes no obligation on Feld Entertainment to provide any information of any kind. Even if they win this case, just from start to finish, that everything we do is a take, there's nothing in Section 9 that obligates Feld Entertainment to provide them with any information.
I mean, is that because your client may decide not to file an application?
Whether we do or not, it's not an obligation. Unlike Aikens,
if you do, won't they be entitled to all the information in the application?
If the Fish and Wildlife Service decides to implement such a proceeding.
No, I thought their point was that under the statute, the application, all the information in the application is public. No?
It is public, but you still have to have such a proceeding. And the record in this case demonstrates...
So it's not public unless the agency decides to have a proceeding about it?
That's correct, and that's illustrated by Judge Garland's opinion in Gerber versus Norton. Mm-hmm. What happens is if a private party submits a permit application, mm-hmm, the Fish and Wildlife Service has to decide to have a proceeding. And what happens is they publish a notice in the Federal Register, they invite comments, and they state that the application is available from the Fish and Wildlife Service.
So two things have to happen. One, the defendant has to agree to file an application, and number two, the agency has to have a hearing.
That's correct. And they don't have any proof that the agency would actually conduct this proceeding. And we actually have evidence in this trial record that was testified to by Mr. Sawalski that in 1975, the company applied for a permit and was told by the agency, you don't need one.
Maybe I'm not sufficiently familiar with Judge Garland's opinion in the Gerber case. I thought the idea is, assume for the moment that you lose this case, and that if you want to continue using the elephants in the way you do, you have to get a permit. Okay, you have to have a permit, right? Because it's a taking. Correct?
So I would not accept that as that, but if I want me to assume
you lose
that
the case.
Yes.
I know you don't accept that you're going to,
yes,
lose the case. I got that point. But
I think
your opposing counsel is correct that for purposes of standing, we have to assume you lose the case on the merits. So going forward from that point of view, if you do have to have a permit, then doesn't the secretary always have to publish a notice of the application for a permit?
If he decides to conduct a permit proceeding.
As compared to what? Giving you a permit without a proceeding?
No, as opposed to telling the applicant, you don't need to do this.
We can't, if we say you do need to do this, Are you saying that the secretary can say, I don't care what the circuit says, we don't have to?
No, I don't think so. I think, again, you get back to the point that we tried this case. That's a factual part of their redressability. It was incumbent upon them to get that information out of some witness, either my clients or out of the Fish and Wildlife Service.
I'm trying to be hypothetical here, just like Judge Tatel. Let me be hypothetical just for the moment. Assume you lose the case on the merits, and you have to have a permit in order to continue treating the elephants the way that you do. Okay? You with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. If you want to treat the elephants the way that you are, then you have to apply for a permit. And when you do, doesn't the agency have to publish notice?
If they decide to do that, they're not compelled to do that, and there's no evidence that they're compelled to do that.
If they don't do that, can they give you a permit?
I think they could not give a permit without doing it. On the other hand, they could do what they did in 75, which is to say you don't need one.
Let me add an additional hypothetical. Let us hold on the merits that you do need one, okay? Now we've just held on the merits, you need a permit. Under those circumstances, when you apply, doesn't the information become public?
If you apply and if they actually conduct the proceeding, it would become public, yes.
They don't conduct the proceeding, you don't get the permit, correct?
Depends on how they interpret the court's decision. That's one of the problems.
We'll be really clear in the opinion. We'll say you must grant a permit. You must have a permit to conduct this kind of activity, okay? Under those circumstances, it's not up to them whether to have a proceeding or not. They have to have a proceeding if you're going to get a permit. The alternative is you get no permit, right?
If the permit under Section 10 can only be issued pursuant to Section 10, which requires the notice and comment, if they decide to have it, they could dispense with it for good cause.
What would be the good cause?
I'm not saying that would be applicable here. But my basic point is, this is a fact question. It doesn't follow as a matter of law from that statute that the court's declaratory judgment will lead to a permit proceeding by the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Two choices. Either you get a permit, or you don't continue the behavior.
Or you present the circus with the other elephants that already have a permit, which is what Judge Sullivan found.
But at least those elephants, you wouldn't be able to continue treating the way,
Well,
I guess I got to add to my hypothetical. Imagine on the merits the court were also to hold that they're entitled to force the regulations requirement of humane treatment. And imagine on the merits the court were also to hold that it's not humane to use these two devices. You couldn't do any of none of the elephants you have with or without permits could then be used.
If that's what the ultimate ruling of the court were, that's what we would be faced with. But my point here is you have a party who still has a decision to make who's not party to the court. And unless there's the Fish and Wildlife Service, and unless they decide to acquiesce in the decision, then this isn't going. None of this stands up.
Unless they decide to acquiesce in our decision.
In your decision. But that's the whole point.
Any case in which a court has held that there's no standing because the United States government may refuse to follow the orders of the court?
I think that was implicitly the issue ultimately in Evans v. Utah and Franklin v. Massachusetts, those two census cases. When they got to the Supreme Court, standing was contested, but the redressability ultimately came through a concession from the Solicitor General that the federal government will abide by
That was the president, right? This is an issue about whether the president could be forced by that.
No, it was the undercounting in the census and the state lost the representative.
But the question was the president had to, in the end, approve. And there was a serious issue about whether the court had authority over the president. We don't have that here.
No, it's a different scenario, but you still have a factual component to the concept of redressability. If the federal government doesn't acquiesce in that...
I'd like to add to Judge Garland's hypothetical. Suppose we don't agree with you that the agency has the discretion, once we rule, not to proceed, not to go ahead. What's the basis then for no informational standing?
The basis is that they've never proved that they were deprived of information to begin with. The witness they put on the stand talked about what they hoped to get, how they would use it, but she never actually said at the time this lawsuit was filed, we are deprived of information as a matter of fact. There's not a single piece of testimony on that. And not only did she fail to testify to it, on cross-examination it was brought out that every single piece of information that permit proceeding would yield, they already had, or got one way or the other through this case. Mm-hmm. So despite all the legal back and forth about whether they have informational standing or not, they fail to prove it as a matter of fact. And I would point out that Ms. Paquette was not the last witness who testified at trial for the plaintiff. She testified on February 19th. That same day, Judge Sullivan ordered the parties to brief organizational standing because they evidently had a serious issue about it. We did so. They didn't rest for five more days. They could have come back and recalled this witness. They could have called other witnesses. They didn't shore up any of the facts that they need to establish either of the organizational or informational theories that they pursued. Thank you.
Thank you. Does Mr. Phillips has any time left?
No.
No. You can take 2 minutes if you'd like it. Yeah. Sir.
I want to focus on the informational standing point, which seemed to interest the court. I mean, I don't think there is any way, candidly, to read this statute, which is 9C, which says the secretary shall publish notice. Notice of any such waiver shall be published by the secretary, and information received by the secretary as part of any application shall be available to the public. That's in the addendum to the blue brief at pages 13 and 14. So there's no question about redressability here. If, in fact, this is a violation of Section 9, and they testified, and I mean, their own testimony made this clear. The general counsel said, when we have to get a permit, we get a permit. And so if this court were to conclude that a permit is required under these circumstances, there will be a filing. That filing will be available. And with respect to the proof here, again, Ms. Paquette specifically testified that they spend tens of thousands of dollars every year trying to get access to information about precisely the conduct that FEI undertakes. And so there's no question that we're not getting that information. Otherwise, why would we be spending money in order to obtain that from independent sources?
What about Mr. Simpson's last point, that the evidence shows that, in fact, you have all the information?
Well, we have all the information in the past, but this is an ongoing responsibility and duty, and this is like FACA. This is not like FOIA, where you say, there's a specific document, give me that specific document, and if you have the document some other way, it moots the case. It's like FACA, where you have an ongoing obligation to provide this permitting information to tell us what takes you are engaged in and seeking approval for or permission for, and under those circumstances, you have to provide specific information. One last point, Judge Tatel.
The defendant could also decide if they lose here not to file an application, right?
They can decide not to file an application, but then there have been clear violation of the statute.
They just couldn't use the elephants anymore, right? I mean, they could decide they're just not going to contest this.
Right, well, right.
The giraffes or something.
Well, they could do that or just, stop the take. But, of course, under this court's decision in Brock, either way, we win. Obviously, by eliminating the take, obviously, then we will have satisfied our need to have our injury based on the take.
But if your standing's based on the lack of information, that you're seeking the information, you wouldn't have gotten the information. Right.
Right, but our standing is also based on the resources that we have to allocate to obtain the information.
Suppose you lose on that.
No, but there are two sources of resource allocation here, Judge Tatel. The one is in general, but the other one is for the specific information. And for that one, it seems to me quite clear that we've got an injury there. And that's a factual injury that the district court did not reject. One last point I want to make is that, the defendant specifically said that if we spent the money voluntarily to provide medical care for the elephants, that would provide us with standing. It seems to me all we're doing here is what we can't, is to accomplish exactly the same thing. The purpose of this is not to educate the public. The purpose of this is to protect the elephants in the only way that an advocacy group can and satisfy the particularized requirements of Article 3 standing. And that's by spending the resources to try to combat, to uncover and combat the illegal actions of the defendant in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much. The case is submitted.
This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30.
Carter, good to see you.